We had a blast this morning. Amanda and I went to the new ropes course, and it is so much fun. I highly recommend it. And speaking of her, I want to brag on my wife, even though she tried to talk me out of doing so. But I want to show you some of her new paintings. Would you like to see them?
Yes.
All right, good. Now, before we show them, she came home from teaching 8th grade biology science one day, and she said, "I'm done." And I'd heard that 1,000 times. I learned how to do motivational speaking by convincing her to go back and teach another day. All right? So this is public school. And she even made the statement, "I will never have an 8th grader. Ever." And by that, my child will skip from 7th to 9th grade. So God cursed her and made her teach 8th grade for 12 years. So anyway, she comes home. Now she loves 8th graders. And so she comes home one day and she says, "I'm done." I said, "Oh, I know it's a summer break." She goes, "No, I'm done. I'm not going back." I said, "Oh, well, what are you going to do?" She says, "I'm going to become an artist." Now, I might as well said, "Yeah, I'm going to be the next president of the United States this next year." You know, I mean, she had no training, nothing, right? And I had seen her doodle on pieces of paper before, and she was quite artistic in her doodling, and she could draw pretty neat, you know, and I knew her mom and dad were both very artistic, but that was the end of that, you know? And I'm thinking, wow, well, here we go. We got to figure out a new financial model for our family because she's not going to teach school anymore. She's going to become an artist. And, you know, there's a famous saying that goes along with artists. You know what it is?
Starving
artist. All right. Well, let me show you what she's done in 6 years of time, having no college education in it, taking a few little classes here and there, like these one-week seminars, and just painting, just practicing. So here you go. All right, that's one of her latest water lilies paintings that has the goldfish and things. That's a very Monet style, and she went to and studied Monet where he lived, and so there's one of those. That's very large, by the way. I go to the next one. That's horses in Colorado. She painted that a few years ago, and about halfway through her six-year career, and that's just right outside our elk camp. It's actually on the property of our elk camp. That's a pretty large painting as well. All right, the next one. That's the cougar that had killed about 500 to 600 elk and mule deer and was hunting by sport by killing and just eating the heart and leaving the animals. So the New Mexico DNR asked if I would like to come and attempt to get it with my bow. And they'd been trying for a couple of years to get this cat. Well, we were very fortunate. I was able to get it, and it's full body mounted in our lodge and just on a tin roof of a cabin. And Amanda decided to make up her own background and add to that cougar. So there it is. So I think that's beautiful. That's also a very large painting. All right, and then the next one, that's a, help me out, Amanda. Impala, thank you, from Africa. So do you have any more? Those are the only four? Did you do your dog? Do we have another one? That's it. Okay. Ask her to show you her cell phone and look at her dog that she just did. She does a lot of pet portraits by commission. And they're just beautiful. I don't know how she does it, but she did one of an 11-year-old Cocker Spaniel, and she really captured it. Just a gorgeous dog. And she does portraits of people, and I am her agent. I get 20% of anything she makes. So, you know, Father's Day is coming up. Now, you can go check out her website. It's AmandaSeitzArt.com, right? Nope, help me out. AmandaSeitz.com. Simple as that. AmandaSeitz.com. So there you go. Yep, that'd be fun. She is really a talented lady, loves the Lord, loves His creation, and is making some neat paintings. Okay, we've come to lesson number 5 in this 6-lesson series, Walking in the Footsteps of Jesus. And last night we ended the lesson as we were looking at the beginning of His public ministry, and we looked at the temptation in the wilderness with Satan. I am not going to jump into the 3.5 years of His ministry. You've heard it 1,000 times. We're not going to go and jump in on a lesson on the cross. You've heard it 10,000 times. We're not going to look at the resurrection. You've heard that 10,000 times. But we are going to pick up on resurrection day, only we're not going to be there in the morning as it's turning daylight. We're going to be there in the evening as it's beginning to turn dark again. And we're going to pick up right there. And this is a place that rarely do you ever find someone teaching or preaching from that moment for the next 6 weeks, because there's not all that much information there. There's some. But I want us to take a look at a very, very important part of the gospel All right? And I want to start with a question. And you go ahead and answer out loud. How many of you have ever doubted something? So you have been told something, and you were very skeptical about it. Matter of fact, you just couldn't make your mind take the trip to actually believe it. You've been there? How many times have you said something, and the person you said it to doubted you? Has that ever happened? Or they just flat out didn't believe you, and they said so. Oh, you're crazy. You're full of bull. You there's no way. Has that happened? It's pretty common, isn't it? I can remember when I was a boy. I think I was around 6 or 7. My dad was in the military for 42 years. So during the 60s, when we were at war, his troop came up, and they were going to have to go for a year. And, oh, I loved my dad. Still do. And I did not want him to leave. My mom didn't want him to leave. My sister didn't want him to leave. Even our dog didn't want him to leave. But he'd packed his duffel bag, and he had his nice uniform on. And they wanted all the soldiers to go ahead and go to the base in the evening and spend the night before they left on the transport plane to go overseas the next morning. Because you needed to go ahead and get that separation from your family, get away, you know. And so we had to say goodbye to him. We weren't allowed to go to the base to do it. And I'll never forget how hard I hugged him and I cried. My mama was crying. My dad was crying. And he turned and got in that old brown station wagon and drove off out of sight. And I was weeping. We were all just crying. And it was a really, really tough time. And I didn't know what I was going to do for the next year of my life. And it was about 2.5 hours later that the door opened, and guess who walked back in with his duffel bag? My dad. I couldn't believe he was already back. And you know what happened? Their orders got canceled, and they didn't have to go. I couldn't believe it. I mean, I literally couldn't take my little brain and make it understand that he was back to stay, maybe just for that night. I just couldn't go there yet. It took a while for me to truly understand that. Now, let me tell you a different story. I'm in my 30s. I was in my late 20s. I'm a youth minister in the Dallas-Fort Worth, Arlington, Texas area. And my secretary says, Jimmy, you have a phone call on line number 2. And the guy says that he is the chaplain and the punter for the Denver Broncos. And so I was like, yeah, I know who this is. This is my buddy Willie Sandlin. So I picked up the phone and I punched it. I said, hey, this is Jimmy Sides. What's going on? And he said, this is Mike Horan. I'm the punter and the chaplain for the Denver Broncos, and we're interested in you coming to speak. And I'm like, oh, yeah, sure you are, Mr. Moran. What'd you say your name is? Moran, what? And I'm just being stupid, you know, and all that. And he goes, this is Mike Horan with the Denver Broncos. And then it dawned on me, this is not a friend tricking me. This really is the all-pro punter, the chaplain of the Denver Broncos. They are coming to town in 2 weeks, and they're going to be playing the Cowboys in a preseason game, and they're asking me to be their speaker at their pregame devotional. Once it sunk into me, I mean, I literally couldn't believe it. Once it sunk in, I was like, I think I was standing up, and I was shaking, and he says, are you available? And I said, let me check. Yeah, you know, just like that. And he said, well, I tell you what, go ahead and show up at this certain time at like 2:30, and you're going to speak at 3:30. And then after that, you know, we'd like for you to go and eat with the team. And then we have a box for you to sit in, and we'd like for you to attend the game, and you can bring one guest along with you. And I said, sounds great. Thank you very much. And I hung up, and I'm like, yeah, I'm just freaking out. And I run in there to my secretary, and I'm like, I'm going to be speaking for the Broncos. She wouldn't believe me. Nobody on staff would believe me. All right? I called my mom and dad. They believe me, but nobody else would. It's one of those occasions where it's just too good to be true, right? It's either too stupid to be true, too bad to be true, or too good to be true. We understand that. We get it. I mean, there's just certain things that don't happen, right? Well, though Jesus had resurrected from the dead, greatest thing in the history of the world, nobody could believe it. When you look back at the text, the disciples didn't believe it. At first, Mary Magdalene didn't even believe it. But finally, she did because of her encounter with Jesus. And she had run back and reported to the disciples that she had seen the risen Lord. John chapter 20, verse 18. Mary Magdalene went to the disciples with the news, I have seen the Lord! Exclamation mark. You know what's interesting is when she first had the encounter with him, she didn't call him Lord. She called him teacher. But Jesus worked with her head and her heart to understand, and he said, don't keep clinging to me, Mary. Don't touch me like that. In other words, don't keep thinking that I am your rabbi, your teacher. I am risen, Lord. Don't cling to the old. Understand the new. And so she ran back going, I have seen not our teacher. I have seen what? Or who? The Lord. Emphatic in the Greek, exclamation mark. Jesus' followers, the disciples, were so leery. They didn't believe her. They were hearing the rumors. They didn't believe the rumors. They didn't even believe one of their own. I mean, Mary had been traveling with these disciples during their 3.5 year time together, and she was one of them, but they still didn't believe her report from the cemetery. One of the disciples was a guy named Thomas. What's he known as? Doubting Thomas. And I think he's received a bum rap for being a skeptic. He has been given that name, but the fact is, all of the disciples were doubters. Every single one of them. They were all skeptical. If you want to fill out your handout, you can write that down. All of the disciples were skeptical. They wanted to believe, but they couldn't believe. Like Mary before, she had actually recognized Jesus. They all thought of death as, here's a very important word, you ready? Irreversible. Say it with me. Irreversible. The rumors of Jesus coming back to life were too good to be true, or they were just too radical to be true. I mean, once a person is buried in a tomb, that person is there for good. Nonsense that person would come out. Nonsense about this wild report of Mary and the other women as they described, you know, Jesus as coming out of the graves in the Synoptic Gospels. And, you know, they were saying basically, we may only be fishermen, but you can't pull the wool over our eyes. We know better. When somebody dies and they're buried, they're not coming back out. You women are hallucinating. Your lack of sleep has caused you to just make this up. And these are the very guys who were still living in their own sleep that had started in the garden, in their own slumber. Look at the reaction of the disciples after the death of Jesus, even after the rumors that were spreading about his resurrection. John tells us they locked themselves in a room for fear of the Jews. They did not want to end up dead like their teacher. Now let me show you one other reason that they just might have locked themselves up. Jump over for just a second out of our text for the night and go to Matthew 27. And look at verse 52 and following. This is actually pretty mind-boggling. We already know that at the crucifixion, as Jesus was on the cross, there were certain things that happened. The devil was waving his victory flag of darkness. We talked about that, right? And he's thought he's won. Well, not only that, when Jesus died, something happened to the curtain of the temple. Do you know what happened to that? Yeah, and by the way, if you read the Apocrypha, guess who sewed that curtain? Mary. It was about 5 inches thick, weighed several hundred pounds, went way up high, many feet. And when Jesus died, that veil that separated the holy from the holy of holies, that nobody could enter but the high priest and only then once a year, it ripped from top to bottom, signifying a move of the holy holies, right? From there to the hearts of the believers. And it ripped all the way from top to bottom. Very significant event that would have shook them like crazy. Wow. And then not only that, something else happened. Are you ready for this? Matthew 27, starting in verse 52. The tombs were also opened, and many bodies of the saints who had fallen asleep, in other words, who had died, were raised. And they came out of the tombs after his resurrection, entered the holy city, and appeared to many. Imagine you're sitting at home around the supper table and the door knocks and your child gets up and goes to the door and opens it and goes, Grandpa! And you just put Grandpa on the ground 9 months ago. That happened. Or you're out walking along the street and all of a sudden you look over and there's your best friend that's been dead for 14 years walking right at you. What do? Run as fast as you can, the opposite direction, right? I said it not long ago. I said, it's like the zombie apocalypse, but they really weren't like zombies. They weren't going like this. They were really alive again. They really were not living dead. They were living. It's crazy. So crazy that the Roman centurion that was not raised in any way whatsoever with Christian ideas, none whatsoever, just the opposite. The Roman centurion, here's what it says about him. When the centurion and those with him, his soldiers, who were keeping watch over Jesus, saw the earthquake and the things that happened. Yeah, dead people walking by. They were what? Terrified. It scared the most calloused men on earth, the winner of gladiator combats, right? It scared them to death. And then they're like, this guy must have been the Son of God. That's what caused them to believe. And did you know there's a tradition that that centurion that was in charge of the crucifixion crew, his name was Longinus, and because of all of this, he gave his life to the Lord, became a Christian, and ended up dying as a martyr for Christ. It's not every day dead people come out of the tomb and walk around, is it? And the disciples were hearing about all this, and they couldn't bring their mind to believe it. And they're locking themselves behind a lock because they don't want to die by the hand of the Jews, or maybe it is that they don't want to see these dead people walking around either. John chapter 20, verse 19. On the evening of that first day of the week, when the disciples were together with the doors locked for fear of the Jews. The evening of the first day of the week. I think if my calculations are right, that would be the Sunday that Jesus came out of the tomb. The disciples were not even close to imagining a resurrection of their dead teacher. And even though Jesus had already appeared to Mary Magdalene and some other women, the disciples still didn't believe. When I was about 5, I got a Daisy BB gun. It was a pump. And you could shoot it, and that BB would almost curveball. And I remember when I was practicing some hunting skills, and I took breadcrumbs, and I put them out, and I hid in a bush, had my camo on. I'd taken the black charcoal out of our trash can where we burned the trash, and I'd covered my face with it, and I'm Rambo with my gun, and I'm waiting, and a little sparrow lit, curveball right through the head, dropped it and dead. First kill. I was ecstatic. I was just, yeah! I grabbed my little sparrow. I go to my neighbors, and I'm knocking on the door. I'm trying to find my sister, and the mom from the house comes to the door and says, she didn't like it. She didn't appreciate it at all. So I go to the next house over. She didn't appreciate it. You better not be shooting my Martins. Don't you shoot my purple Martins. I'll whip your honey. She didn't appreciate my sparrow. And finally, I found my sister. She's like, gag, and she runs. So I go into my mom, and my mom, man, she appreciated it. Good, son. She hugged. Now, let's take it outside. I was so proud of that sparrow. And then I laid down in my bunk bed. You know, I think my bunk bed was an incubator for thought. I thought of so many things, from the boogeyman in the closet to who the Easter bunny was to the tooth fairy. And it was in my bunk bed. I found out my mama was the tooth fairy because I risked tooth fairy etiquette one night when she came to my bed. And I had a tooth under my pillow. And I decided that night, I'm going to find out who the tooth fairy is. So I faked sleep. And when I felt that rustle go under my, I half opened one eye, risking maybe the loss of that eye if I looked the tooth fairy in the face. And you're not going to believe it. I found out my mama is the tooth fairy. I'm not joking. My mama is the tooth fairy. I could not sleep. Of all people in the world, my mama is the tooth fairy. And I went to school the next day. I think I was around the second grade. And I told everybody, my mama's the tooth fairy. And they're all like, well, my mama is too. And I'm like, no, my mama is. I saw her last night. You dummy, so is my. And then all of a sudden, boom, it hit me like a ton of bricks. And this light came on in this dark brain, you know, and I was like, oh, man, everybody's mama's the tooth fairy. And then I start thinking about Santa Claus. Now, you know, and that's when I was figuring it out. That was my bunk bed. Oh, so many thoughts were incubated in that bunk bed, you know, and came to life. Well, I'm lying there in that bunk bed that night, and I start thinking about that little bird. Poor little bird, mama's missing it. Oh, God, please bring that bird back to life. You raised Jesus from the dead, and you raised all those people, and you said you're going to raise us. Please bring that little bird back. I cried myself to sleep. Man, my pillow was soaking wet. I was crying for that little bird. I just knew in the morning when I woke up that that little bird would be gone. And that little bird was dead as Rover all over the next day, just stiff and had mites on it. First unanswered prayer. Whew. Tough one for a little kid, isn't it? So I buried it in a shoebox. I felt so bad. And I had a funeral in the backyard. And I made my dad come preach. And here, you know, we bury the bird. And I want you to imagine if 3 days later, if my neighbor, the same one that says, "Don't you be shooting my purple martins," what if she'd have come over to me and said, "You're not going to believe what I saw out my window. Of all things, I saw a little sparrow crawling up, working its way, digging its way out of the ground. And I went out there, and sure enough, I looked down there, and there was an empty shoebox, and the lid was gone, and that little bird flew off, and I'm feeding it up there now." I would have run down there, and I'd have looked, and I'd have thought, nah. I mean, somebody dug it up. The cat ate it. I wouldn't have believed it, even though I prayed for it. Would you have believed it? Because it just doesn't happen. You know why? Because death is what? Irreversible. Right? Once it's dead for good. Well, Jesus knows that that's how we think. And so he had to initiate something, matter of fact, a series of them, to make sure that the irreversible was understood to be reversible. The cross had taken care of sin. The resurrection had out-deceived the great deceiver. But what came next would determine if the cross and the resurrection would have lasting impact. So let's take a look at what came next. The appearances. In Luke 24, Luke gives a touching account of Jesus' sudden arrival along two very forlorn followers that were going on the road to Emmaus, a town about 7 miles out from Jerusalem. And these two grief-stricken disciples have left Jerusalem. They're walking these 7 miles, and their faces are downcast. Luke 24:17 says they were very sad. Luke 24:21 describes them in a state of lost hope. It says, "We had hoped that he was the one who was going to redeem Israel, just like I had hoped that the Predators were going to beat the Penguins, and they didn't." And I've just been sad ever since, man. Just dragging around and moping, you know. So was my son. So was all of Nashville. We had hoped that he was going to be the one. You see, they'd been taught from birth that someday a Messiah would appear and deliver their country from the oppression of the Romans. All of that seemed to be happening through this person called Jesus, but now he's what? Dead. He's killed by the very ones that he was supposed to deliver them from, the Romans, and even some of the Jews that were not good people. And these two men's traditional beliefs about the Messiah were being put to the test. These two disciples had heard the rumors about a risen Lord, but they were skeptical because, after all, death is what? Irreversible. Maybe that's why Jesus chose to appear to them. Let's read this together. It's Luke 24, beginning in verse 13. Now that same day, two of them were on their way to a village called Emmaus, which was about 7 miles from Jerusalem. Together they were discussing everything that had taken place. And while they were discussing and arguing, Jesus himself came near and began to walk along with them. But they were prevented from recognizing him. Then he asked them, "What is the dispute that you're having with each other as you're walking?" And they stopped walking and looked discouraged. The one named Cleopas answered him, "Are you the only visitor in Jerusalem who doesn't know the things that happened in these days? "What things?" he asked them. So they said to him, "The things concerning Jesus of Nazareth, who was a prophet, powerful in action and speech before God and all the people, and how our chief priests and leaders handed him over to be sentenced to death, and they crucified him. Oh, but we were hoping that he was the one who was about to redeem Israel. Besides all this, it's the third day since these things happened. Moreover, some women from our group astounded us. They arrived early at the tomb, and when they didn't find his body, they came and reported that they had seen a vision of angels who said he was alive. Some of those who were with us went to the tomb and found it just as the women had said, but they didn't see him." That's a pretty big but right there, isn't it? I call it the big but of Scripture. But they didn't see him. In other words, I don't think we believe it. He said to them, "How foolish and slow you are to believe all that the prophets have spoken." Emphatic exclamation mark in the Greek. "Wasn't it necessary for the Messiah to suffer these things and enter into his glory?" Then beginning with Moses and all the prophets, he interpreted for them the things concerning himself in all the scriptures. They came near the village where they were going, and he gave the impression that he was going further. But they urged him, "Stay with us, because it's almost evening, and now the day is almost over." So he went in to stay with them. It was as he reclined at the table with them that he took the bread, blessed and broke it, and gave it to them. Then their eyes were opened. By the way, that was something that was done to them. That's the way the Greek words make you understand it. It was done to them. Their eyes were opened, and they recognized him, but he disappeared from their sight. Then they said to each other, "Weren't our hearts burning within us while he was talking with us on the road and explaining the scriptures to us?" So that very hour they got up and returned to Jerusalem. And that's 7 miles. They just walked 7. They're running the other 7. They found the 11 and those with them gathered together who said, "The Lord has truly been raised and has appeared to Simon." Emphatic exclamation mark. Then they began to describe what had happened on the road and how he was made known to them in the breaking of bread. So now the 11 are going to believe, right? Wrong. They're in the locked room. They hear the report of yet some more people that have seen Jesus. But if they didn't believe Mary and the other women, why would they believe these two guys if they didn't see it with their own eyes? So for this reason, Jesus chooses to appear specifically to the whole group. We pick up in verse 36 of Luke chapter 24. As they were saying these things, he himself stood in their midst. He said to them, "Peace to you." Do you ever remember another time when he said peace? Why did he say peace during that occasion? What was it? Storm on the Sea of Galilee. As a matter of fact, it was a storm that they were so afraid, they thought they were going to die. And then they look out and they think they see what? A ghost. And they're just flipping out. It's a ghost. And Jesus comes over. I mean, it's scaring them to death. How would you feel if you saw somebody walking across the lake at night in a storm, middle of the night, in the glow of the lantern? And you're about to die anyway because you're about to drown in the middle of the lake. And so what do? And he says, "Peace, peace be with you." And he calms the storm. I'd say that we're dealing with a storm here. They've dealt with a lot. They're behind locked doors. They're having a hard time believing. And all of a sudden, boom, there he is, just like that. Ghost, peace, he says to you. Now, verse 37, but they were startled and terrified and thought they were seeing what? A ghost. Why are you troubled, he asked them. That's a strange question. Why do doubts arise in your hearts? Look at my hands and my feet, that it is I myself. Touch me and see, because a ghost does not have flesh and bones, as you can see that I have. And having said this, he showed them his hands and his feet. Now they're going to believe, right? That's going to do it for them, right? Wrong. They still don't believe. You know why? Because death is irreversible. And they think they're seeing a ghost. Now, I am not an authority on ghosts. But I do know this. If there is such a thing as a ghost, the last thing I would expect the ghost to do is eat a piece of fish. But that's exactly what Jesus does. Look at verse 41 and following. But while they still were amazed and in disbelief because of their joy, he asked them, "Do you have anything here to eat?" So they gave him a piece of broiled fish. I guess they were trying to stay healthy, not fried, broiled. And he took it and ate it in their presence. He told them, "These are my words that I spoke to you while I was still with you, that everything written about me in the law of Moses, the prophets, and the Psalms must be fulfilled." So now they believe, right? I mean, after all, a mirage can't make a fish disappear. Wrong. Even after the ghost ate some food, they still did not believe. So Jesus is going to have to go to extreme measures with them. So what does he do? Verse 45. Then he opened their minds. That's something in the Greek that's done to you, it says. It's being done to you. You can't do to yourself. He opened their minds to understand the Scriptures. He also said to them, this is what is written. The Messiah would suffer and rise from the dead the third day, and repentance for forgiveness of sins would be proclaimed in his name to all the nations, beginning at Jerusalem. You are witnesses of these things. And look, I'm sending you what my Father promised. As for you, stay in the city until you are empowered from on high. So now they finally believe. Because like the two disciples on the road to Emmaus, their eyes have been opened. Their minds have been opened by Jesus. That's what it took. Yet, there's someone missing. Who is it? Thomas. Doubting Thomas. He was the only one of the 11 apostles bold enough to be outside of the locked room. We don't know where he's at. We don't know what he's doing, but at least he's not hiding in there like a coward. We're not sure what he's doing. When the disciples were reunited with Thomas, they told him in John 20, 24, "We have seen the Lord." Who else said that? Mary Magdalene. "We have seen the Lord!" Emphatic, exclamation mark. Jesus is no longer just a teacher in their mind. He is the Lord, the risen Lord, the Son of God. Yet Thomas has the same reaction that the rest of the disciples had initially displayed. He did not believe. So what does he say? He say to them? Let me tell you something. Unless I see him, unless I put my finger in those nail holes, And I put my hand in his side where that spear went in, I will not believe. For the next 7 days, Thomas held true to his word. Though I'm sure the disciples continually tried to convince him otherwise, he stood firm in not believing in the resurrection. Therefore, Jesus made it a point to appear to Thomas. This is in John, if you want to go to that in your Bible. John 20, 26 through 27. A week later, his disciples were in the house again, and Thomas was with them. Though the doors were locked, Jesus came and stood among them. Same as the week before, right? So what do you expect Jesus to say? Because after all, at least one of them is going, ah, right? It's probably Thomas having that reaction this time. And so I think Jesus is speaking to Thomas. "Peace be with you," he said. Then he said to Thomas, "Put your finger here. See my hands? Reach out your hand and put it in my side. Stop doubting and believe." Now naturally, you're going to expect that Thomas is not going to believe because Jesus hasn't opened his mind yet. You think he's going to do the exact same thing that the other 10 apostles did, right? Wrong. As a matter of fact, look at verse 28 to see the reaction of Thomas. Thomas said, "My Lord and my God." Now wait a minute, Thomas. That's not what you're supposed to say. You're supposed to respond with fear and think Jesus is a ghost. You're supposed to continually doubt like all your buddies did after Jesus showed them his wounds. But such is not the case. Thomas believed. And Jesus didn't even have to eat a piece of fish for him. Jesus didn't have to open the mind of Thomas. So I want to suggest to you that the phrase "doubting Thomas" is not a real nice thing to throw on him. But isn't that what we do? Don't we label people? Don't we like to just flippantly throw out labels? And guess what? Labels stick. And labels can really hurt. And you could label somebody even inaccurately, and it could cause the rest of the world to think that how you labeled them is accurate. So you need to be super careful about labeling people. All of the apostles were doubters, but the least of whom was Thomas. I mean, after all, death is what? Irreversible. likely all of us would have been finding it hard to believe. We'd have had a tough time with the rumors of the risen Lord. Maybe like Mary Magdalene, like the other women who went to the tomb, like the disciples behind locked doors, like Thomas, maybe we would need a very personal, intimate encounter face-to-face with Jesus in order to truly believe. And that is why it's so important for Jesus to make personal appearances during his 6 weeks between the resurrection and the ascension. These appearances were planned. These were part of the overall mission, the strategy of God. Because during the 6 weeks that Jesus walked on the earth between the resurrection and the ascension, he makes approximately a dozen appearances. He's there, then he's gone. The appearances are not spectral, they're not ghost-like, they're flesh and blood encounters. He always proves his identity in every appearance. After all, no other living person bears the scars of crucifixion. Yet, often the disciples fail to recognize him right away. Painstakingly, he condescends to meet them on their level of skepticism. For Mary Magdalene, he calls her by her first name, just like the shepherd calls his sheep by their name. For the two disciples on Emmaus, he walks with them. He breaks bread with them. He communes with them. He opens their eyes. For the apostles and the disciples behind the locked doors, he breaks bread with them. He eats fish in front of them. He opens their eyes. For Thomas, he fulfills his wish to touch the nail holes and the hole in his side. For Peter, later on, he's going to cook Peter a fish breakfast after once again showing Peter that he's Lord of the fish by helping him with his miraculous catch. Then he's going to take Peter on that walk on the very shore that they grew up on. And he's going to tell Peter three different times, "I want you to take care of my sheep, the church." And that was one for each of the three denials that Peter gave. So he could specifically say to him, "I forgive you for denial number one and denial number two and denial number three, Peter. Now you grow and go." And then look at the man he became. I love reading 1 and 2 Peter because that's not this young, hook-nosed, barroom brawler, sharp guy to get out and jump on you and cut your ear off and fight you and defend Jesus. Now, this is a seasoned elder of the church who's wise beyond his years. That's a great couple of books to read from the New Testament. And that happened because Jesus took time to have that intimate encounter with him on his own home turf where he had gone back to the familiar. All of the appearances of Jesus between the resurrection and the ascension show a definite pattern. He visited small groups of people in remote areas or behind closed doors. Although these private rendezvous bolstered the faith of those already believing in Jesus, about 500 in number, as far as we know, he never appeared to one single unbeliever. And I've sometimes wondered why Jesus didn't make more of his appearances. Why limit visitations to friends and disciples and to only 500 of them at that? I mean, this is the stuff I think about when I'm sitting in a deer stand or when I'm fishing. And I'm always wondering about stuff like this, trying to come up with an answer. Here's my answer. I mean, if it was me, this is what I would do. And I've got this crazy warped brain. But the first person I would appear to is Pilate. And I would show up right in the middle of one of his meals with his wife. And I'd have a basin in one hand and a towel in the other. And I'd go, "Boo!" And his wife would go, "I told you! I told you!" That's one of the things I've come up with. And then there's that time I'd appear before the Sanhedrin. And I'd just let them have it, you know? Scare them to death. Perhaps a clue to Jesus' strategy can be found in his words to Thomas on the day of Thomas' skepticism when it finally melted away. He says, "Because you have seen me, you have believed. Blessed are those who have not seen me and believe." Jesus was not concerned about appearing to unbelievers. He knew, listen to this, this is crucial. He knew that the crucial mission was to ensure that the believers believed. Do you get it? Who else is going to start the church? During the 6 weeks between the resurrection and the ascension, Jesus broke his own rules about faith. He made his identity so obvious that no disciple could ever deny him again, and none of them did. In a sense, he overwhelmed the witnesses' faith. And anyone who saw the resurrected Jesus basically lost the freedom to choose whether to believe or disbelieve. Jesus was now irrefutable to them. And even his own brother, James, who was so skeptical that at one time he thought his brother was crazy, he was so convinced in the post-resurrection appearances that he was swept away by belief and became one of the great leaders of the church in Jerusalem. And according to Josephus the historian, he died as one of the early Christian martyrs. Jesus says, "Because you have seen me, you have believed." These privileged few could hardly disbelieve. But what about all of the others? What about every person on earth who has not had the privilege of seeing Jesus face to face, up close and personal? Jesus knew that very soon his personal appearances would come to a halt, leaving only the small group of those who have seen, and the church would either stand or fall based on their witness. They had to be persuasive. They would be eyewitnesses for everyone in the world, including us today. They are our eyewitnesses because we haven't seen. Jesus had 6 weeks in which to establish this identity for all time. And the resurrection, without the appearances of Jesus, would have lost its persuasiveness. The appearances of Jesus to the believers who were to perpetuate the gospel were more than critical. They were absolutely necessary. And so this leads me to summarize three things about belief. Three remarkable pieces of evidence emerge as a result of the resurrection and the appearances, hand in hand. Here's the first one. Jesus succeeded in changing an unreliable group of followers into fearless evangelists. Think about that. Some of them uneducated, some of them just rough fishermen, some of them tax collectors, and he changed them. This wishy-washy, unreliable group that he used to just pop himself on the forehead and go, "Good grief, y'all got to be the dumbest people I've ever seen in my life. Can't you get this? How long am I going to have to stay with you? How long am I going to put up with this?" I mean, Jesus actually has those frustrations in Scripture. It's recorded. And he's got to take those people and change them into fearless evangelists. Here's the second one. The 11 men who deserted him in the Garden of Gethsemane on the night of his betrayal went on to martyrs' graves, avowing their faith at their death. John is the only one that didn't die a death, at least at the hand of a gladiator or being boiled in oil or torn apart by horses, but he was exiled on the island of Patmos in his older years. Something happened to him, didn't it? And here's the third one. The small group of people who saw Jesus after his resurrection managed to set loose a force that would overcome violent opposition first in Jerusalem and then in Rome. It worked. It succeeded. And the church was established. And this remarkable sequence of events is the reason that we're here tonight. You ever thought about that? If it weren't for the 500, we wouldn't be here tonight. If it weren't for Jesus taking the time to plan out and work the plan out of his appearances to those 500 people to the point that they could not believe, then we wouldn't be here tonight. And we wouldn't have the hope of Christianity and eternal life that we have. It would change everything for us. So this remarkable sequence of transformation offers, I think, the most convincing evidence for the reality of the resurrection. What else explains the whiplash change in men that were known for their cowardice and for their instability. All one has to do is read the gospel's descriptions of how the disciples that were huddling behind the locked doors, and then they proceed on to the description of these same guys in the book of Acts who are publicly proclaiming the gospel in the point of being flogged and killed, tortured. It's an amazing thing. And these are all results of the personal appearances of Jesus. So fast forward 2,000 years later. Here we are, Hume Lake Camp. We're considering the events of Resurrection Sunday and the weeks that followed. I think what we need to hang our hat on, the peg that we need to drive in a wall and hang our hat on regarding our faith is this. It's what Jesus said in the midst of all this. He said it during his appearances. He said this, "Blessed are those who have not seen and yet," what? "Believed." Did you know that he blessed you during his appearances? He spoke words about you during that 6-week period. I think that's really cool.